Good afternoon. Hello and welcome. I am Dr. Rosemary Walsh, and on behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to thank you for joining us for today's educational activity, Neuromyelitis Optica Spectrum Disorder Unveiled, Optimizing Long-Term Outcomes in Neuromyelitis Optica Spectrum Disorder with Innovative Therapies. Today's activity is supported by educational grant from Alexion Pharmaceuticals. So CME Outfitters is a joint accreditation provider and as such develops and certifies continuing education activities for the team, by the team, including our program today. I also want to encourage everyone to join us today on our live Twitter conversation at CME Outfitters. We will be monitoring the Twitter feed and responding to your tweets as they come in. Also, I want to remind our audience that our iPads and online platform you are using today allows you to save slides, take notes on slides, answer our polling questions, and send us your questions, so please log in and interact with us. We'll only be taking questions through that system, so please utilize that system for questions. So again, I am Dr. Rosemary Walsh. I am a neuroimmunologist at Memorial Healthcare in Owosso, Michigan. Neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder is one of my passions, and I am joined by two wonderful colleagues as I moderate this panel.
I'm Mary Jean Busey. I am a nurse practitioner and a clinical professor. I'm the professor at Stony Brook University and a nurse practitioner at NYU South Shore Neurological Associates on Long Island.
And I'm Dr. Flavia Nelson. I'm a neurologist and the chief of the CNS autoimmune disorders. It used to be the MS division. And also the director of the MS Center of Excellence at University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. I've been doing MRI research for the past 20 years, and now I date it myself. Thank you for coming.
And Chelsea Tucker is our patient advocate that we'll be seeing on video today. She's also an artist and an advocate. So today's learning objectives, we're going to review the pathophysiology of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, including the role of complement mechanism in the disease state. We are going to evaluate the diagnostic criteria, including reviewing the clinical presentation, the AQP4 IgG status, also known as the aquaporin 4 status, MRI findings to accurately and earlier diagnose neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. We're going to review the recently approved NMOSD therapeutics in preventing new clinical attacks, associated damage, and long-term disability. And then we're going to discuss how to implement ongoing care needs and monitoring of patients with NMOSD to optimize long-term outcomes as we move into this new era of NMOSD management. So this is a very devastating disease, and we like to start off with a patient experience here.
My name is Chelsea Tucker. I am 37 years old, and I am diagnosed with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. I was initially misdiagnosed with MS when I was 21, and I lived with that MS diagnosis for nearly a decade before my symptoms led me to a diagnosis of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder in 2019. My initial symptoms were vague. I had constant nausea, vomiting, which was new to me, migraines. I had rapid heart rate. I was just having a wide variety of symptoms that didn't make sense. I was sent to multiple specialists, and I was diagnosed with POTS syndrome and celiac disease. That went on for about 2 years, and finally I woke up one morning with excruciating pain behind my left eye and blindness. I knew at that point that there was something very wrong, and I was directed to go to the emergency room, and I was there diagnosed with optic neuritis for the very first time. From there, I had spinal taps and all of the procedures, blood work and MRIs that eventually led me to a neurologist who was able to diagnose me with MS.
NMOSD is a rare afflicting disease in that it affects about 1 of 10
per person, per 100,000 people globally. In the United States, there is about 22,000 persons diagnosed with NMOSD. It affects East Asian and African descent disproportionately. The typical age is between 35 and 40 years. However, it can be diagnosed at earlier or later, but rarely in children and adults, older adults. It's predominantly female, and it's especially in the relapsing NMO IgG positive. The high female predilection is up to 9%, 9 to 1 in females versus males. The clinical course varies over time. The person may start out with an acute relapse, and 90% of patients experience this kind of relapse. And it worsens over time, where relapses become longer, more severe, with less recovery. And this accumulating disability causes chronic disease and chronic disability. NMOSD misdiagnosis is really common. Between 25 and 40% of people were initially misdiagnosed, oftentimes with multiple sclerosis. And diagnosis can be very complicated because there's a significant variability in disease course and presentation. If a patient is sent to the emergency room or to their primary care provider, most providers there have limited or no experience with NMOSD. And patients describe that they've been called they're faking a disease or there's much difficulty with diagnosis. In fact, 71% of patients say the first healthcare provider that they saw was not helpful. And so if you look at this, the circles, you'll see how NMOSD intersects with MS, ADEM, and MOGAD. And it's a big problem when people are trying to be diagnosed. The consequences of this misdiagnosis are delays in maintenance therapy, inappropriate or harmful treatment, especially with MS therapies, greater frequency and severity of relapses, and increased risk of permanent disability. I just want to call your attention to this, how NMOSD impacts the quality of life. If you looked on the left side, the red and the orange are all of the time or most of the time. And look at what the patients go through. It is just remarkable about every part of their life is affected by NMOSD.
So I'm going to talk about neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder pathophysiology, the presence of autoantibodies, and the complement cascade. So proposed NMOSD pathogenesis. Aquaporin 4 is expressed, a water channel that's expressed on the astrocyte and feet. So this is responsible for regulating the bidirectional flow of material across the blood-brain barrier. It's very prevalent in the optic nerve, the spinal cord, and areas of the brainstem that we will come back to later as we review MRIs, but this is why areas of the brain are more susceptible to an NMOSD insult than others. And this is an autoimmune disease in which an anti-AKP4 antibody is produced. So reactive T cells prompt this production of these autoantibodies that are produced downstream via the B cells, ultimately the plasmablasts, and mitigated partially by IL-6, and they target the AQP4. Thus, the AQP4 antibody test has nearly 100% specificity for neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. When I teach, I talk about complement activation really being a forest fire. We start off with just a little bit of like ashes into that complement, and what happens is you continue to spread that fire, and that's what happens with complement activation as it crosses in the blood-brain barrier and causes all of that inflammation to continue to come in and continue to have all of that swelling, and it's this big fire, forest fire, that just keeps going. So complement is activated, the cascade promotes neutrophil chemotaxis, and then the MAC deposition. And this is predominantly a problem in the astrocytes. So that complement-driven inflammation causes severe astrocyte necrosis. So those astrocytes swell up and die. So then that causes more inflammation to come in. your GFAP, which is an emerging biomarker in neuromyelitis optica, is released by those astrocytes. This astrocyte continues to compromise the blood-brain barrier and then promotes further CNS inflammation. And then you have secondary damage to the oligodendrocyte that drives the demyelinating process and the axonal degeneration. And this is the process explained now in a cartoon that we just went over discussion-wise, but also discussing where the different therapeutics that are used both here in the United States and around the world, both on-label and off-label, work. So in the periphery, we have the B cells here. So rituximab here works on the CD20, and ibalizumab works on the CD19, which are ultimately responsible for producing the anti-AQP4 antibody. You have your IL-6s working here, satralizumab and tocilizumab, that are in this production in the periphery as well. Down here, across the blood-brain barrier, you have complement. And so complement inhibitors, eculizumab and ravulizumab, work here to stop that complement production as well. And so this is when the AQP4 attacks and we lose the astrocytes, and then we have the secondary oligodendrocyte damage. This cartoon also says where MOG works, because we really can no longer talk about neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder without at least also simultaneously talking about myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein-associated disorder, which is a similar but different antibody-mediated disorder. So how do we test for this disease? A cell-based assay is preferred. Ultimately, a fluorescein-activated cell sorting test, which is nearly 100% specific for that anti-AQP4 antibody. Other cell-based assays that are available on the market are over 90% specific, which is really good if you're wanting to rule in this disease. Sensitivity, so to rule out the disease, is 70 to 90% overall. There is other testing available on the market called ELISA. It's commercially available but not preferred, and sensitivity is significantly affected, and antibody titers can fluctuate. We can have false positive based on other antibodies that exist, and we do recommend retesting if you're uncertain on the diagnosis. Blood testing is often preferred over CSF because it's more sensitive and it's less invasive, but there are certain cases that you might need to consider CSF in.
Okay, so now we get to talk about clinical, serological, and radiological criteria, and you get to test your knowledge. So let's talk about Angela. She's a 32-year-old African-American female that presented to the ED with an acute onset of neurological symptoms. She reports malaise and fatigue, followed by persistent nausea and vomiting for the past 2 days. Today, she woke up with severe weakness and numbness in her lower extremities, leading to difficulty with walking and standing, and she also reports a band-like sensation around her abdomen and urinary retention. So, upon examination, she has decreased strength in her legs, 2 out of 5, hyperreflexia, and a sensory level at T6. Cranial nerve exam reveals mild facial asymmetry and difficulty with gag reflex. Her past medical history, she had migraines diagnosed at age 30, accompanied by visual disturbances, nausea and vomiting, managed with prophylactic propranolol, 20 milligrams PO twice a day. She was diagnosed with hypothyroidism at age 26, which is managed with levothyroxine, 175 micrograms PO daily. And she has a family history. Her mother has Sjogren's syndrome, no other significant family medical history. So, which of Angela's presenting symptoms most strongly suggest brainstem involvement? A, malaise and fatigue. B, persistent nausea and vomiting. C, severe weakness and numbness in the lower extremities. D, band-like sensation around her abdomen, or as patients like to call it, the MS hug, which is obviously not just for MS. And you do not know, because I do. Go ahead and enter your answers, and let's see what it shows. Look at that. Very good. Persistent nausea and vomiting. Very, very good. So 88% of the people in this room get to have cookies. All right. Excellent job, everyone. And, you know, if you didn't answer correctly, that's okay. It's okay. You're learning about NMOSD, and that's what's important. And if you can help one or two patients because of what you learned today, you should be happy.
Well, and let's talk about, Dr. Nelson, where that weakness and that band-like sensation really localizes to.
Oh, I don't know. The resident did the neurological exam. Okay, so let's talk about the core clinical characteristics. We all know optic neuritis, right? Bilateral or unilateral. We also know acute myelitis. And the one that is not as well known is the area post-trema syndrome. And we'll talk more about that, and I'll show you on the MRI what area is affected. Then we also have an acute brainstem syndrome, or ABS, number four. I don't know if I can. Number four over here. I don't see it very well from here. And number five, asymptomatic narcolepsy or acute diencephalic clinical syndrome with NMOSD typical diencephalic MRI lesions. And number six, and that was number five, over here in the front. And number six, symptomatic cerebral syndrome with NMOSD typical brain lesions. So let's talk a little bit more about that. Transverse myelitis. The patient is usually, most of the time, going to present to the ER because the symptoms are very dramatic. And it's going to be weakness or paralysis of limbs, torso, and plus minus respiratory muscles, which is more rare, but it can happen. They also have painful tonic spasms, sharp shooting radicular pain, pruritus, numbness, tingling or burning sensations, and bladder and bowel or sexual dysfunction, right? And usually the diagnosis is made after an MRI is obtained, and we can see the lesion on the spinal cord on MRI. Optic neuritis usually starts unilateral, can become bilateral, one eye after the other, sometimes both, partial or complete blindness, loss of visual acuity or color saturation, retrobulbar pain that worsens with eye movement, and abnormal or asymmetrical pupillary response to light. And remember, in general, the optic neuritis that we see with NMOSD tends to be a little more dramatic than the one we see with MS. And we'll talk more about that, and it's also proven by OCT findings. And then at the bottom, you see the area post-trema syndrome, which is intractable nausea and vomiting, plus minus hiccups. Now, the one that is not as common will be the brainstem diencephalic or cerebral syndromes, which you're going to have your narcolepsy with autonomic dysfunction. Remember, our patient was talking about how she had rapid heart rate and nobody could figure out what was going on. So that was likely an autonomic dysfunction. Difficulty speaking, swallowing, or breathing, right, from brainstem damage, facial paralysis, severe headaches, visual disturbances, and altered mental status, which is your encephalitis. And then vertigo, hearing loss, tinnitus, encephalopathy, changes in mental status can happen, hydrocephaly and seizures, and fulminant neurogenic respiratory failure. I actually had a patient with that and diagnosed with MS. So what about the diagnostic criteria? So in 2015, an international panel for NMOSD diagnosis, the IPND, gathered and came up with two different diagnostic criteria, one for aquaporin 4 positive and one for aquaporin 4 negative NMOSD. So in the aquaporin 4 IgG positive, we must have one or more core clinical characteristics, which are positive tests for aquaporin 4 IgG using our best available detection method, the cell-based assay, which is strongly recommended, and exclusion of alternative diagnoses, your sarcoidosis, your paraneoplastic syndromes, vasculitis, chronic infections, etc. It's extremely important. And then in your NMOSD with aquaporin 4 negative or unknown, because you don't have the test available or the answer yet, you must have two or more core clinical characteristics occurring as a result of one or more clinical attacks and meeting all of the following requirements. One or more core clinical characteristics must be optic neuritis or acute myelitis with longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis, which we will discuss when we talk about MRI, or the area postrema syndrome. Also, dissemination in space, and we're not talking about space on the MRI. We're talking about two or more findings on clinical exam or clinical characteristics, and fulfillment of additional MRI requirements as applicable, as well as a negative test for aquaporin 4 IgG using best available detection method or testing unavailable, and again, extremely important, exclusion of alternative diagnosis. Now, they came up with a proposed NMOSD diagnostic algorithm, which I'm sure is similar to what you do. So if you have a patient in which you suspect NMOSD, the most important thing, in my opinion, is to get a very, very good history and clinical exam, right? Meaning, do not go by the previous neurologist note or the resident that took the HMP at 3 o'clock in the morning. You take your own exam, you talk to the patient preferably, if possible, get it from the patient, and then if you still suspect NMOSD, then you go to your testing. So let's go down to the right. You're going to do your general immunological lab works. Your MS mimics, all the tests that we do serologically to rule out MS mimics, such as ANA, etc. CSF analysis, and you save a little bit of CSF if possible, because if you do your aquaporin 4 testing and it's negative, you may want to do it in the CSF, just a suggestion. And then also you're going to do your MRI and your OCT. The OCT is going to be also very helpful. Then you go there to make sure you don't have any red flags in that workup and check for alternative diagnoses. And then, of course, I'll turn parallel to your other testing. You're doing your aquaporin 4 IgG cell-based assay. If positive, you go down to the INPD criteria for NMOSD. Do we meet, does the patient meet criteria, right? It's not just the test, it's everything. So if it's positive, you check for criteria. If it's negative, you may repeat in serum or you may do it in the CSF. And then if it's negative, you can also test for IgG for MOG. And if that's positive, then you consider MOG EM or MOGAD, encephalomyelitis or MOGAD. And if it's negative, you may repeat as well. And then again, on both sides of the algorithm, depending on what you get, you're going to ask yourself, does this patient meet the NMOSD criteria? And I want to mention that there is no one test or one thing that you can do to be sure of the diagnosis. I think what I teach my residents is the history and presentation should fit, the neurological exam should give you some clues, and then you go for your testing, your lab testing, right? And then you go for your MRI findings, and then at the end, your CSF and MRI findings, and then the other aquaporin 4 testing and MOGAD, and you make sure that everything fits. So let's go to my favorite section. It's demyelinating, it's relapsing, but it's not MS. So what are the red flags and clinical pearls? And I'm going to get up for this one so I can point at the MRI, and I apologize to the people on the left. I'm probably going to have to point on the right because it will be easier, so I'm not turning this way. Can you hear me? Okay. The other mic is on. So, remember Angela? Okay, so Angela started on high-dose corticosteroids and sent for lab work and imaging, and here are the results. Aquaporin 4 IgG is positive. Anti-MOG IgG is negative. We have oligochromal bands are absent, hint, hint. Protein level elevated, 100 milligrams per deciliter, and white blood cell count elevated, 20 cells, likely lymphocytes, or it could be neutrophilic pleocytosis. And then on MRI, you're going to have a sagittal T2-weighted brain spine MRI with poorly delineated hyperintense signal changes and an enlarged spinal cord extending over 8 to 9 spinal segments or longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis. And a hyperintense dorsal medulla area postrema lesion is also seen. Now, let's see. Here's the area postrema. You see the red arrow. It's underneath the fourth ventricle. Can you guys see it over here? It's not in front of the fourth ventricle. It's underneath. It's easily seen when you have a sagittal T2. And this is a sagittal T2. We know that it is a T2 because the CSF is white, right? And then you start seeing the T2 hyperintense signal in the spinal cord, right? The spinal cord is wide, it's enlarged, it's swollen. The signal is white. This MRI doesn't have contrast, so the signal is hyperintense or white, and it goes all the way from C1 to approximately C1, 2, 3, 4, and then there's a little space where you don't see a lot of signal, and then it starts again, right? So it's a little patchy, but it's definitely a longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis. Then again, it starts around T1, and then notice this. Underneath this segment that looks hyperintense or white, you also see a hyperintense signal that is not as white, but it's definitely going all the way from C1 to the end of this picture. So, again, it doesn't have to be continuous and it doesn't have to be the same level of hyperintensity, but this is definitely a longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis. Now, how many of you look at your own MRIs? Raise your hand. Good. I'm so proud of you. Always look at the T2 sagittal and look at the axial. The axial will allow you to see the extent of these lesions, and you will get a better idea of the degree of damage because the T2 sagittal may be deceiving sometimes. Sometimes it looks worse. Sometimes it doesn't. So next, here's your quiz. So which combination of findings in Angela's workup is most specific for NMOSD? Okay, is it the anti-aquaporin 4 IgG positive and the LETM, longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis that we saw on the MRI, or is it the aquaporin 4 antibody plus the absence of oligoclonal bands, or what about the longitudinally extensive TM and the absence of oligoclonal bands, or the aquaporin 4 positive and the anti-MOG negative, or you don't know, and that's okay. Let's see what we have. I know this group was very smart, so I'm not worried. Okay. So the answer is 76% the anti-aquaporin 4 IgG positive and the longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis. Although, you know, none of the answers are wrong. They really are not wrong. It's just that this will be the best indication that this is NMOSD. So kudos to you. And it's okay to say I don't know.
I'm going to stop you right there. There's been quite a few questions about how we individually apply that diagnostic algorithm and how we arrive at our diagnosis in NMOSD, and I'm going to collectively bring all those questions and let Dr. Nelson answer them as she goes through these next couple slides. So I think that will help a lot of you with this. She's going to walk through optic neuritis cases that look like NMOSD and area postremia and longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis, and she's going to talk more about how she arrives at the diagnosis of NMOSD. So there's been lots of questions about that. So
okay.
She's going to address that, I promise you.
And we will have a question and answer
session. Absolutely.
So, you know, if I don't cover everything as we're going through the slides, please just bring it up again. During the question and answer session, because it's a lot of material, but I'm so glad that you're interested and you're asking and happy to answer all the questions and stay late. Okay, so let's talk about optic neuritis, okay? So as you know, NMOSD requires normal findings or nonspecific white matter lesions on brain MRI. So first thing, you need to look at your brain MRI. right? You shouldn't have a lot of lesions, or they should be atypical, right? They're not going to look like MS, or usually. And the problem is when you only have one or two, right? And you really don't know what to do with one or two lesions. So then, you, like I said, you have to start collecting data. So with optic neuritis, it has to be, you have to see either a T2 hyperintense lesion, right, like the one we see over here, right? This is a T2, and you see a hyperintense signal. And this doesn't necessarily need to be when the lesion is enhancing. The T2 hyperintense signal, you may see it even if you no longer see enhancement. Remember, enhancement doesn't last more than a couple of weeks. So sometimes you don't see that patient with optic neuritis right away. Why? They go to the optometrist, and then the optometrist sends them to the ophthalmologist, and then the first ophthalmologist misses it because they don't see anything in the on fundoscopy, right? And they're not thinking. Some of them do, some of them don't. We have all kinds. And then eventually it gets to you. And by then the nerve may not be enhancing anymore, but you still have to go back and try to put the puzzle together and look at, you know, if they got any imaging at the time of the attack, etc. But if you're lucky enough to see the patient when the attack is happening, you want to get a brain MRI and you want to get an orbital MRI, and you want to look at the T2, but also at the T1 post-contrast. So as is showing you here on these slides, we see a T2 hyperintense signal on the left eye, but also we see on post-contrast imaging, this is a T1, CSF is dark, but it's got contrast inside the veins. This is the contrast. And you see the contrast enhancement in the chiasm, right? So T1-weighted gun-enhancing lesions, more than half the length of the optic nerve, or involving the optic chiasm. And this is why they're going to have bilateral optic neuritis, because the chiasm is affected, right? So again, evaluate your cases of optic neuritis. Look at your own MRIs. Not only look at the axial, right? This is the axial, and you want to look at the orbits in the coronal plane, which you're only going to get that coronal plane if you order the orbital MRI. And then you want to look at your MRI of the brain, and also look at T2, T1, post-contrast. What do the lesions look like, right? Everything is going to give you a clue. I heard you had a wonderful imaging lecture this morning. So MRI is fascinating if you pay attention to it, and it can give you so much information, more than we think. So let's go to the next slide. Spinal cord lesions, right? That is the bread and butter of NMO. So we usually require, or we want in NMOSD aquaporin 4 positive, we expect to see a longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis and at least three contiguous segments in patients with a history of acute myelitis. And so you see beautiful over here on this one, NMOSD, right? You see the signal on, again, this is a T2 weighted image. How do I know that? Because the CSF is white, so CSF in front of the spinal cord, which is dark, right? This is a T1 post-contrast. The CSF is dark. We don't see this white line over here. And you see the contrast enhancement up here and above C1, medulla. But then you see these lesions over here that say MS. And I am sorry to say that NMOSD, especially the NMOSD aquaporin 4 negative, may look like this. So, again, this brings me back to the MRI cannot diagnose NMOSD or MS or anything, because they can all sometimes look alike. And these lesions can be seen in NMOSD. So if you see this doesn't rule out NMOSD, right? Even if you have, an aquaporin 4 negative, that's what makes it hard. That's when you're going to bring your other, all the other information, the oligoclonal bands, the OCT, etc. Correct? So here's your area postrema syndrome. It's easy to miss on MRI, right? You have to be looking at the brainstem very carefully, preferably on a 3D, meaning usually most of the patients, they get an MRI, and you're going to have a 3-millimeter slice thickness or 5-millimeter slice thickness, right? That's a lot of gap between picture and picture. So preferably, if you have a 3D, which is 1 millimeter between each picture, you might be able to catch it. And there it is. It's, again, underneath the fourth ventricle, right, and in the posterior part of the medulla, not the ventral part. And here you see it, it looks like a donut around the canal, right? You see it here, and here it's unilateral. So I'm going to point again on this side. It looks like a little white donut. This is a T2 flare, and unilateral on the left side only, down here, and underneath the fourth ventricle in the posterior area. Now, it's very important that you look at the T2 flare, preferably 3D, not 2D, because that gives you, again, pictures every 1 millimeter. But it's also very, very important that you look at the flare, the T2 flare, and the T2, the regular T2, the one with the white CSF. So a T2 flare is just a T2 with the CSF turned black. So it's the same image. You're just going to, in one you see the CSF, in one you don't. And getting rid of the CSF sometimes makes things better, but in the posterior fossa, down here, it may not be as helpful as in the brain. So please look at both carefully, slice by slice, and compare the T2 flare with the T2. If you have EPIC, you can do that. And they're very easy to miss, so you want to look at the axial and you want to look at the sagittal. So this study by Lu Z from 2011, they look at 30 people with MS, 30 people with NMO, and 30 people with ADEM. I'm not going to go into ADEM that much, but basically what they found is that the lesions for NMO, where the borders were more irregular and they were asymmetric. In MS, the lesions were more regular, the borders were more regular, and they were also asymmetric. And in ADEM, the symmetry is what kind of, you know, made it different. So ADEM can look like NMO. We won't go into that because that's a complicated story, but the symmetry may give it away, as opposed to asymmetry in MS, asymmetry in NMO, and then irregular borders in NMOSD and regular borders in MS, if that's helpful. Again, you have to look at T2 flare, and post-contrast images carefully, preferably 3D. So other brainstem syndromes. Okay, we need to look at periependymal brainstem lesions, which we did. And look at these lesions. I can't see them very well from here, but look at these lesions again in the area postrema, right? And in one particular, in CA, you can see lesions in the midbrain, lesions in the pons, and lesions in the medulla, which interestingly also Lu Z found that in the midbrain they were more common in ADEM, in the pons they were more common in MS, and in the medulla they were more common in NMOSD. Is that helpful? I don't know. It was only 30 patients in each category. But, you know, if you want to remember some of those things, I think the best thing is just when in doubt, when you don't know what to do and the whole picture is not giving you an answer, then you repeat the MRI and see if the change in the MRI gives you that answer, right? Sometimes we don't have it right away. Sometimes you have to repeat imaging and look at how the patient evolves. So, red flags, take home points. I would say you don't need to remember all of this, but remember the main ones, okay? Aquaporin 4-0 positive is going to be an MOSD. MOGAD, no. Attack recovery. Most people with MS recover completely, right? Not in NMO, not in MOGAD, right? And we already talked about bilateral and unilateral optic neuritis. CSF. Here it is. CSF oligochondral bands, rare in NMOSD, very rare, very common, right? 90 to 95% of the patients with MS have positive oligochondral bands and rare in MOGAD. And last but not least, your spinal cord lesions. Now, if you know any of my research, you know that I love cortical or just the cortical lesions. And Lu Z also said they're very helpful to diagnose NMO and NMOSD. You're not going to see them in NMO, but guess what? Most people don't know how to find them. They're very difficult to find if you don't have the right sequences. And most places in the country do not use the right sequences to detect cortical lesions. So we're not there yet, okay? We're working on it. And I think something else to remember is, aside from the longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis here, is this. MOGAD is going to involve the conus medullaris, the tip of the spinal cord. So if you see that, you want to think MOGAD, right? So that's the end of my section, and I'll pass it along to Dr. Welch. Oh, we have the...
Yeah. We're going to return back to Chelsea as well as we start to talk about NMOSD treatment and how to optimize outcomes from acute treatment to chronic management. So thus far, we've kind of talked about how we make that diagnosis, how we do that workup, and now we're going to talk about how we treat somebody acutely and how we manage them long-term.
So the first treatment that I started were injections at home, interferon medication, and initially I was told that it should work, it should be fine, and that wasn't the case. I got very sick. Besides side effects, I relapsed again with optic neuritis, yet again in my left eye about 3 months after I started the injections. Once I failed that medication, I tried a different medication, and I tried that, it didn't work, and that was hard. I then started a different injection at home and was told this really should work, and it didn't. And at that point, it was no longer these medications were failing me. I started to take it personal. Like, I was failing the medications. If there was something wrong with me, I was extremely discouraged. It felt like no matter how many medications I tried, no matter what I did, even if these medications should work, my body just wouldn't tolerate them. I got worse. I didn't have a period of remission or disease where it wasn't active. It was constantly active. Finally, after the third failed injectable medication, I was put on an infusion. That was the hardest of them all. The side effects weren't as bad as the injections, but the optic neuritis attacks kept coming back in my left eye more frequently. It led me to a point of about 2 years where I threw up my hands and said, like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And I went unmedicated for about 2 years due to the frustration of just not having any luck on any of these medications. After that 2 year period of not being medicated, I woke up with blindness in both of my eyes, and it was bilateral optic neuritis. That's the first time I've ever experienced that. And eventually that led to more testing. I was not diagnosed immediately after with NMO once I had it. Bilateral optic neuritis. It took about 2 years.
So Chelsea's story is a very common misdiagnosis story, where she was originally misdiagnosed as multiple sclerosis and actually ended up with a diagnosis of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. Thus, failing MS medications, as a question came through, is actually quite common because the wrong disease was being treated. So when Chelsea went to the hospital this time, she needed to be treated for that acute bilateral optic neuritis. And the importance of treating this acutely was because recovery after attack or relapses is typically poor and incomplete. So that optic neuritis does not recover back to normal visual acuity. It normally leaves some residual blindness. So we define attack as emergence of new NMOSD-related symptoms and or exacerbation of pre-existing ones for greater than 24 hours with or without new or enlarging or enhancing MRI lesions. There's also a concept of a pseudo-attack, which is worsening of pre-existing neurological symptoms attributed to non-NMOSD clinical factors, such as infections, fever, injury, comorbidities, medications, psychiatric disorders. We are very cautious in calling something a pseudo-attack on neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder because infections also increase the risk of an attack. So it's something we always need to take into consideration when an NMO patient calls with new symptoms. Those incomplete recoveries can lead to accumulating disability, an attack leading to blindness, an attack leading to myelitis with quadriparesis. That leaves residual disability and worsens quality of life over time. And each subsequent attack can increase in severity and duration over time. And inappropriate treatment can worsen disease, increase in disease activity, relapse frequency, and or relapse severity can be associated with initiation of many MS drugs. So our interferons are glatiramer, natalizumab, alemtuzumab, fingolimod, and dimethyl fumarate are just some of the ones that are known clearly to worsen NMOSD. And so it should raise your flag if you have an MS patient who's worsening on some of these higher efficacy drugs that you might not have the right diagnosis. We don't use a lot of methotrexone or cyclophosphamide anymore due to limited effectiveness and high risk of severe adverse effects. So our goals are to minimize attack damage through rapid initiation and early escalation of acute therapy. So using high-dose corticosteroids, typically IV methylpred, and or plasma exchange, or IVIG. And then also chronic therapy, that goal is to prevent relapses and therefore prevent the attacks that cause that worsening disability through early initiation of long-term maintenance therapies. Until the past 7 years, everything that we were using was off-label and traditional immunosuppressive therapy, low-dose corticosteroids, azathioprine, mycophenolate, and the traditional monoclonal antibody rituximab. In the past 7 years, we've had several FDA-approved therapies in this nation, including eculizumab, inotuzumab, satralizumab, and ravulizumab, with the goal to prevent a future clinical attack. And then we also treat patients symptomatically to maximize their quality of life, as you saw earlier, with all of those symptoms that these patients have and they live with. This ends up becoming very patient-specific and symptom-guided. So a patient comes in with an NMOSD attack of an optic neuritis, an area posteremia, a longitudinally extensive myelitis, and we treat them with high-dose IV methylpred, 1 gram for 3 to 5 days. And depending on the severity of attack, they get plasma exchange or IVIG, depending on the institution as well. If IV methylpred does not elicit an adequate response, I encourage PLEX or IVIG, depending on the institution, early. And then acute therapy must be followed by some form of an oral corticosteroid taper to prevent subsequent attacks as you get a patient on a maintenance therapy. And we're going to talk about the maintenance therapy.
If I just may add something, I just want you to know that and I didn't know this myself, but we have the number one neuro-ophthalmological institute in the country, the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute, and they use up to 10 days of IV solumedrol, up to 14 days of IV solumedrol before they go to plasma exchange. So if it's a severe case, we don't have to stay with just 5 days. I've done 7 before, never heard of 14, but the head of the Bascom Palmer Institute, you know, does that, and I respect him significantly. And we have the luxury of having patients go to the Bascom Palmer ER, and they get treated immediately. They get an MRI in the ER. They start treatment. So I'm very lucky, but I've also learned from them. So just think of it that way. Don't give up on IV solumedrol and go to plasma exchange immediately. You can stay with IV steroids a little longer and give it some time to respond.
And then these patients are normally in the hospital, and one of the questions that came in virtually was, what's the role of physical and occupational therapy? And I highly encourage these patients to get moving as early as possible in the hospital to prevent the complications of a DVT or a PE and get function back as fast as possible and prevent the decubitus ulcers that can form if they're in bed too long. So get those therapists involved early as possible. So let's talk about maintenance therapy in a patient who is AQP4 positive. The goal is to start immediately after the first clinical attack because there's a high risk that this is going to be a relapsing disease if they have the anti-AQP4 antibody. So treatment choice is highly variable and very patient-specific, but approved monoclonal antibodies are preferred at this point in time over traditional immunosuppressive therapies whenever possible. At this time, there is no therapy that's approved for seronegative NMOSD, so treatment recommendations are currently driven by expert opinion. Now, this algorithm actually comes out of Europe, but it actually is kind of helpful as we try to move forward because there are no head-to-head studies in NMOSD. And so what is the first choice therapy for a patient? And that's a very patient-specific decision. So whether or not they are a complement therapy patient, whether or not they're a B-cell therapy patient, or an IL-6 therapy patient depends on what their attack severity, their recovery, what the patient can tolerate, can the patient inject themselves, do they have access to an infusion center, what are their comorbidities, do they have other autoimmune diseases that I'm going to try to use one drug to treat multiple diseases with, what is the concern for a side effect or a safety profile, what's their age and their family planning process, what's the patient preference, what's the adherence, what will a patient adhere to? Will a patient self-eject? Will they show up at an infusion center? What's the availability and the cost in the market that you're in? And then what would happen if a patient has a clinical attack on one of these medications? So the current consensus recommendation is to switch to a different class of medications. So that if you fail on a complement therapy, the recommendation is to switch to an IL-6, or a B-cell therapy. If you fail on a B-cell therapy, to switch to another class of medications. And then if you fail again and you continue to fail, that you start to combine therapies. But at this point in time, they tend to be very refractory, and clinically I've only seen this with what we call paraneoplastic NMOSD related to their underlying cancer. So off-label therapies that were used for many years and many patients may have been on and many patients may still be stable on include mycophenolate, anywhere between 1,000 to 200 milligrams daily. This can take 4 to 6 months, even up to a year, to have full effect. Oftentimes, we need to maintain patients on corticosteroids in the interim. Safety concerns include that it's teratogenic. We can see pancytopenia, hypertension, ulcers, hepatotoxicity, pulmonary toxicity, nephrotoxicity, an increased risk of serious infections and malignancy. Azathioprine is also used at around 2 to 3 milligrams per kilogram per day, also a pill. Again, it takes about 6 months for full effects, often needing corticosteroids in the interim. Also teratogenic can make somebody hypofertile, pancytopenia, pancreatitis, hepatotoxicity, pulmonary toxicity. We're seeing a pattern here. And then corticosteroids, and ideally, the American College of Rheumatology even recommends that we get patients on 10 milligrams or less, ideally 7.5 or less of prednisone a day. Because prednisone comes with all of its other side effects. Because we can see bone fractures, diabetes, we have an obesity crisis in this country, dyslipidemia, cardiovascular disease, we can see myopathy, and this long list of problems with steroids that continues to go on and on. So that's why many of us who treat NMOSD tend to prefer the monoclonal antibodies. So for a long time, rituximab was the most robustly used among off-label therapies, and until 2017, this was the only good therapeutic option. So it's an anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody. You achieve B-cell depletion usually within 4 weeks, with full onset within 8 to 12 weeks. Dosing is typically 1,000 milligrams IV on day 1 and day 14, and then dosing is a little tailored to patients, but between 500 to 1,000 milligrams every 6 months thereafter. Some patients get one dose, some patients get two doses. There were no adequately powered randomized control trials, but retrospective reviews demonstrate a 70 to 96% reduction in relapse rate for this drug, albeit very small trials. The adverse events that we see with rituximab include infusion reactions, upper respiratory tract infections, late onset neutropenia, hypogammaglobulinemia, and reactivation of viral illnesses. And now throughout the rheumatoid literature and also the oncology literature, we're seeing ongoing concerns about polymorphism data, about people who bind genetic differently and genetic polymorphism that could affect the efficacy, and ultimately the memory B-cell depletion in older B-cell therapies. So we're going to go back to this pathophysiology diagram just so I can kind of put this back in your head a little bit on where these drugs work and how we're going to continue to talk about them as we move to the now FDA-approved therapeutics. So we can see over here, we're going to talk about the complement-based therapies, eculizumab and ravulizumab. We are going to talk about IL-6, which is satralizumab, and we're going to talk about inebilizumab, which is a CD19 therapy. So eculizumab is considered an anti-C5 monoclonal antibody. It's given over 90 minutes via IV. It's a standardized dosing of 900 milligrams per week times 4 weeks, and then 1,200 milligrams every 2 weeks. And it's very quick onset, within 1 to 2 weeks. The PREVENT trial was the trial that got this drug FDA approved, and it treated AQP4-positive antibody NMOSD patients who had very active NMOSD. So they had 2 relapses in the last year, or 3 relapses in the last 2 years, including 1 in the past year. And they had to be somewhat ambulatory with that EDSS of less than 7. And it was randomized 2-to-1 to eculizumab to placebo, and they were allowed to continue on their traditional immunosuppressive therapy. This study actually demonstrated a 94% relative reduction in the risk of relapse with eculizumab versus placebo. We saw adverse effects of headaches, upper respiratory tract infections, arthralgias, malaria, and GI upset. We also had to be very cautious about anemia, leukopenia. We did see a couple rare fungal infections and an allergic infusion reaction. But the most important thing to be aware of with complement therapy is that there is a REMS program and an increased risk of meningococcal infections. Therefore, we do need to vaccinate against both meningitis A and meningitis B due to the increased risk of encapsulated bacterial infection. This year, a longer-acting complement therapy came to market called ravulizumab. It's an anti-CD5 monoclonal antibody, but it's longer acting. So instead of being dosed every other week, it's dosed every 8 weeks. And this is actually a weight-based IV infusion. You have a day 1 loading dose that is weight-based, day 15 maintenance dose, and then every 8 weeks thereafter with onset of action within the 1 to 2 weeks. This was the CHAMPION NMOSD trial, and this was what's called a time-to-event external comparative randomized controlled trial. What that means is that they actually took the placebo trial of the PREVENT, which was the eculizumab trial, and used that to compare this trial to, because at this point in time, it was now considered unethical to have a placebo-controlled trial in neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. They enrolled slightly less active NMOSD patients, with 1 relapse in the past 12 months, still ambulatory, and they were allowed to continue their baseline immunosuppressive therapy. This study demonstrated a 98.6 relative reduction in relapse rate with ravulizumab versus placebo, and we saw very similar side effects because it's a very similar mechanism of action, just a longer time between infusions. So again, we had to worry about those hematological abnormalities, and we had to make sure we were vaccinating against meningitis. The patients who were treated with ravulizumab during the CHAMPION NMOSD trial, it was a very novel response that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine because nobody had a clinical attack while on treatment. Inebilizumab is an anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody that's a 90-minute IV. You are pre-medicated with an antihistamine, an antipyretic, and a corticosteroid. You receive 300 milligrams on day 1 and day 15, and then every 6 months thereafter. You do have B-cell depletion within 2 weeks and full onset within the 6 to 8 weeks. This was done in a large randomized controlled study, time-to-event double-blinded, called the N-Momentum study. Again, they enrolled active NMOSD patients with 1 relapse in the last 1 year or 2 in the last 2 years, and they also had an EDSS of less than 8. And they were randomized 3-to-1 to inebilizumab versus the placebo. So in the AQP4-positive patients, there was a 77% reduction, relative reduction in the risk of relapse versus placebo. We did see some upper respiratory tract infections, some UTIs, and some arthralgias, which we do see with B-cell therapies during infusions. And then there were a couple life-threatening infusion reactions, but very rare. Some opportunistic infections, viral reactivations. The class has a warning against hypogammaglobulinemia and concerns in animal models that it might be teratogenic. Satralizumab is the only injectable therapy that's available on the market. So it's a self-administered sub-Q 120 milligrams every 2 weeks times three, and then every 4 weeks thereafter. It takes about 12 to 24 weeks to start working. There were two different studies that this was completed in, the Sakura Sky and the Sakura Star, which were both time-to-event, double-blind, randomized controlled studies. So Sakura Sky did enroll patients who were AQP4 positive with greater than 2 relapses in the past 2 years, including one in the past year, in ages 12 to 17. And they were randomized 1-to-1 with satralizumab or placebo. And you could ultimately see that there was a pooled analysis with a 75% risk reduction in AQP4 antibody positive patients receiving satralizumab. Now, side effects that we did see, injection site reactions, and that makes sense based on how the drug is administered, headache, arthralgia, upper respiratory tract infections, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, elevation in LFTs, cholesterol, and triglycerides.
Okay, now we're going to talk about ongoing monitoring and supportive patient care, but we're going back to Chelsea.
I've been relapse-free for almost 3 years, thank goodness. I mean, I'm completely blind in my left eye, and I've been that way for a long time, so I can pretty much count on my vision not returning in my left eye. But my right eye is something that we have to preserve. I had issues with being immobile, so I had paralysis and numbness in my legs, and I just remember how hard it was for me to go through that and how hard it was for my family to watch me go through something as devastating as losing my eyesight and losing my ability at times to be mobile. I don't have celiac disease. Vomiting profusely and having such trouble and nothing was helping is something I still struggle with now. And it's not anything correlated with food. It's because of NMO. Navigating a healthcare system, oh, it's very hard. It's very hard. You almost have to become an expert in your body, and you have to be well-versed in the disease that you have, because oftentimes I'm speaking with people, doctors, medical staff, who don't know what NMOSD is. It's such a vulnerable state of being to not be able to see what's going on around you and to have to navigate and advocate for your healthcare in that situation is challenging, to say the least. My neurologist has been integral in me being well-versed in NMOSD. I am so blessed with an amazing neurologist who doesn't just focus on the big symptoms, but also focuses on the symptoms that are big, in my opinion. I know eyesight is a massive symptom to pay attention to, but I have very limited feeling in my hands. And so we're working on getting more testing to figure out exactly where that damage is coming from and if it can be reversed. I have an amazing support team in my primary care doctor who works very closely with my neurologist regarding my care, which is, I can't ask for more. It takes a huge burden off of me. I would tell that I have the very best doctors overseeing my care.
So some of the ongoing monitoring needs. Thus far, the parameters for ongoing monitors has not been, there's no consensus in that. So neurological assessments can be routinely or as clinically indicated or once every 6 months or once every 4 months, depending on the patient. And the purpose is to monitor disease activity, residual symptoms, and response to treatment. Brain and spinal cord imaging can be routine, or if symptoms occur, if new symptoms occur, you certainly want to do that again. And you want to detect any new lesions, assess disease burden, and guide treatment adjustments. The lab tests should be done periodically, as I've said about everything else, or as indicated, depending on which medication you're on. And the labs, CBC, BMP, GFAP, and others are indicated by treatment protocol. The purpose is to monitor treatment effects, potential seroconversion, and comorbidities. And then the monitoring, it really depends on what the patient's on. For long-term steroid therapy, for a monoclonal antibody, you really want to do a regular assessment of efficacy, side effects, opportunistic infections, and long-term safety concerns, especially, as Dr. Walsh said, with steroid therapy, long-term steroid therapy. And then we have quality of life. And you heard what Chelsea said about quality of life, and we'll just continue with that in a second. So symptomatic and supportive care is unbelievably important in this disease. Our patients are suffering with every single day, as we saw in that first, what their quality of life is like. They have motor dysfunction. So I look at this whole thing and I say to myself, oh my gosh, I wish we had every therapist. We need rehab, vision impairment. We need ophthalmology involved. We all need to go to Miami, right, for her ophthalmologist. Neuropathic pain and paresthesias, how do we treat it? Some people treat with gabapentin. Some people treat with Cymbalta. We try not to treat with any opioids. We might send the patient to pain therapy, pain management. It really depends on their pain. Spasticity and tonic spasms, we're using medications. Are we going to use a baclofen pump at times? I don't know. Are we going to use Botox? These are questions that we still have, and it depends on the patient. Bowel, bladder, and sexual dysfunction, very high for these patients, and they may need to see urologists. And we talked about it today, not here, but in other places, that nobody talks about sexual dysfunction. I mean, no primary care, no provider really wants to say, oh, yeah, let me talk about that. So that's one thing that's probably an unmet need that nobody really talks about because it's difficult for us. But who is it? John Foley will be talking about it soon in this conference. Fatigue and disordered sleep is another problem for our patients. Pregnancy, should they get pregnant? What if they're on therapy? Should they not get pregnant? Their disease has to be monitored closely because there can be increased activity during pregnancy. What about psychiatric and cognitive impairments? I know in my practice, I can't find anybody for my patients to talk to. In our whole region, we have no psychiatric providers who will talk to a patient and medicate. It takes months, and most of them, many of them, want cash only. So it's really a difficult problem. I think it's mental health needs are dramatic across the United States. Infection and vaccines, we said that we have to be cautious about that with these medications. What about autoimmune comorbidities? Sjogren's and lupus are the most common comorbidities with NMOSD. Psychosocial support, social work. Some MS centers have, who see all these patients, have social work in their clinic, and that is something that is just remarkable, and I would like to work there. Patient care and partner education. This is your nursing staff. This is what we do. Besides the neurology staff, it's the nursing staff. We do this, and we do this well. We talk to our patients. We educate our patients every time we see them. So there's so many needs that our patients have, and they're still unmet because of our lack of providers in our regions. And now, Rosemary.
So we did review a ton of stuff today, and there are plenty of questions here, and I'm so impressed with how engaged all of you have been. So I do want to kind of circle back that we've looked at the patient experience and the impacts of living with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. We are working to increase the rate of accurate NMOSD diagnosis by implementing the latest diagnostic criteria and cell-based antibody testing. We spent a lot of time with Dr. Nelson distinguishing NMOSD from MS lesions on brain and spinal cord imaging. We talked about reducing the time of initiation of NMOSD maintenance therapy in newly diagnosed patients. There are many, many questions here about which one to use, which one do we use first, the financial impacts of this, insurance barriers, and those are all very fantastic questions and barriers that we all face on a regular basis. Different states have different policies, so it is very hard to address those questions here right now, but something that this community as a whole is working on why patients might need or want access to FDA-approved therapies, or why somebody might choose an older monoclonal antibody therapy that's on the market, but that should be a decision that lies with the patient and the physician. And then implement appropriate monitoring and supportive care measures. So these are unmet needs in neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. So one of the questions is, how often do we see asymptomatic MRI lesions? And there is one NMO study out of the N-Momentum study potentially addressing this, but this is an unmet area of need in NMOSD. Do we see asymptomatic MRI activity in NMOSD or do we not? Do we repeat their MRIs at 6 months on therapy like we do with a lot of MS patients and then image them periodically? Or do we just image them when they have a clinical event? What do you do? Dr. Nelson's and my practices are probably very different, but nobody has exactly the right answer at this point in time. And this is what the next decade of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder care is going to bring us and how we bring this all together in the best care moving forward. Trending AQP4 activity, that's a great debate in this country right now. That question has come up multiple times here. Some people will follow that titer and consider, as a patient's been living with this disease for 40 to 60 years, can they follow that titer and potentially take that patient off? And others will argue if a patient is on a B-cell therapy that that titer is now going to be negative, and is it safe to take a patient off therapy for NMOSD? When do we take a patient off therapy for NMOSD? There was one correction I did want to make about the satralizumab slide. It is approved for 12-year-olds in Canada, not the United States, but it is studied down to 12-year-olds here. So we are going to continue to do questions because there's lots of questions up here.
I just wanted to add one thing. It's so important because our patients feel alone in this. They really do. They don't have anybody to talk to because they don't know anybody who has this disease. So social media is so important. There are Facebook groups. You can go to you can send the patient to the Guthrie Jackson Foundation, the Samara Foundation, or the Cernus Foundation, because they also will help. They have a lot of videos, and they have a lot of interest in what NMOSD is, and also they can help with funding for drug for treatment.
So, Dr. Nelson, there's actually several MRI questions for you, as you figured were coming. One of the questions is, are you aware of the prevalence of longitudinally extensive myelitis that is not AQP4 positive?
I do not know a percentage, but, you know, we have many other diseases that can actually give you that kind of myelitis. I've seen lupus give you a longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis. I've seen what looks like a demyelinating disease and is actually an AV fistula and gives you that kind of longitudinally extensive. Also, there was a case of varicella zoster myelitis that also showed a longitudinally extensive transverse myelitis. So, again, MRI is really just showing you what's happening, you know, in the spinal cord, and that may give you clues into the etiology, but it's not going to be pathognomonic for any disease. And that's why I kept saying, you know, it's all got to come together in every aspect of that we discussed. So I do not know a number, but I can assure you that it happens in many other diseases.
Okay. And then one of the questions is actually about posterior fossa lesions. So this would apply to both multiple sclerosis and NMOSD. Why is T2 better than FLAIR?
Well, let me see how I can make it fast. So the cerebellum has a lot of gray matter, as you know, and the brainstem, for some reason, sometimes when you look at the flare, it just doesn't show the lesion as clearly as the T2. So I think it's just depending on the signal, right? On that particular person, because the signal can change depending on the person. So I don't know if it has to do with the amount of water that they have, because that plays a role in the T2 signal. I'm not sure the specific answer from the I'm not a physicist. I would not be able to tell you. But I can assure you that it's not necessarily that T2 is better. You know, I used to think it was better, and then I started looking at both. And, you know, 20 years experience of looking at MRIs, not only of my patients, but I used to look at MRIs from multicenter clinical trials and looking at MRIs that were coming from all over the world. And basically, I don't think there's a rule, so I would say look at both. right? In general, the T2 should be better because if it's gray matter, it's going to show better on the T2 and not on the flare. But the flare sometimes picks them up better. It's a good question for me to look into. Why? But if you look at both, then the chances of missing it are less, which is really the point.
So there are also several questions on pregnancy and women of childbearing age. This happens to be one of my favorite topics and a topic that I could talk to you for about 4 hours. So there are no consensus guidelines yet on management of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder in pregnancy. You know, it's something that a lot of us have talked about working towards. There is a lot of data out there that, unlike other autoimmune diseases, neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder may actually worsen during pregnancy, and that we need to discuss this with patients and work in conjunction with OB and maternal fetal medicine to help women have healthy babies. There's no clear indication on whether or not a patient needs a vaginal delivery or a C-section. There's ongoing registries about use of the current FDA-approved therapeutics during pregnancy, but there's currently no recommendation to use any of them during pregnancy. This is a case-by-case scenario that's handled. So it's a conversation that needs to be had. Still, 50% of the pregnancies in the United States are unplanned, so it probably will happen. It's happened to me in my attending career. I've had an NMO patient become pregnant, and we navigate it. And we navigate it the best we can, working with that patient on a very individual basis. There are a lot of questions about, again, which drug to use first, or X drug costs this, X drug costs this. And today we're just presenting you the science of these drugs. I would love to have a public policy debate about cost of care of medicine and preventing patients from being in the hospital, because an ICU stay for PLEX is quite expensive, and we do need to factor all of that into considerations of cost of care, but that's beyond today's discussion.
I would just add, I think, you know, rule of thumb, if the antibody is negative, the aquaporin 4 is negative, you cannot use the recently approved FDA drugs, right? So right away, you know. Unless you have that test and it's positive, the insurance is not going to approve it. So I say, in the meantime, while you're waiting for a test, go ahead and start something as soon as possible, right? You can always change later. But to me, access to a therapy as fast or as soon as possible is important. And sometimes even with a positive aquaporin 4 test, you know, the delays are unacceptable, which is something that, again, we're not going to waste time discussing, but I would say prevent relapses. That's your main goal. Start treatment as soon as possible with whatever you can, and every place is different. And then think about whether you want to change when you have more time. Protect the patient above all.
And there are a lot of questions about the complement-based therapy and the vaccination protocol. So there is a REMS program for the complement-based therapy that will be fully active in the fall. There is a schedule for vaccination of both the meningitis A and the meningitis B, including the updates of when they need to be vaccinated. So they do need to be vaccinated against both meningitis A and meningitis B. You need to have both vaccines, at least one dose prior to initiation of complement therapy, or be being pre-treated with antibiotics, and you do need to be updated on that vaccination per that protocol every 2 to 5 years, depending on the vaccine that they are getting. There was a question also about the cases of meningitis during the CHAMPION NMOSD trial. So I would actually pull out the data on that trial, because the United States has a very different vaccination protocol than other countries do. So if you are really curious about how cases of meningitis happened in other countries, it's actually detailed out in the supplementary area of the CHAMPION NMOSD study. To the best of my recall of the CHAMPION NMOSD study, none of the cases were here in the United States, per our recommendation on the immunization protocol. There's a couple questions about MOG. There is currently nothing FDA approved to treat
MOG, antibody positive disease. So there are a couple ongoing clinical trials with different treatment options. So that's exciting and hopefully coming to market in the next 3 to 5 years. But this field of neuroimmunology is vastly changing, which is why we're constantly talking about these diseases.
And when in doubt, if you don't know if it's MS, NMO, or MOG, then you know that there is one drug that will cover all of them, right? And sometimes we cannot solve those puzzles. I also want to say, I don't know if you have seen patients in their 60s and 70s with NMO, but I've seen many cases. So don't discard the diagnosis of NMOSD, even with aquaporin 4 positive antibody, in patients in their 70s. Mm-hmm. It's actually more common than we think.
It's a subset called late onset NMOSD. So my oldest in fellowship was 88. My oldest as an attending is 78. What's your oldest right now, Dr. Nelson?
No, I think they're younger than that. Yeah. I would say 77.
So, yeah. But it happens.
It happens, yeah. I have 3 or 4.
Yep. And we talk a lot about this being a disease that preferentially attacks African Americans and Asian women, which it does, absolutely. But we also see it in men. We see it in white men. So just don't discount the disease because they're not the right ethnicity. There is some emerging data that those who present with area postremia syndrome actually take longer to get diagnosed, which actually makes sense to me because somebody coming in with chronic nausea, vomiting, and hiccups, a neurologist or an ophthalmologist is not going to be the first stop. It's going to be a GI doctor. Mm-hmm. So those with an APS presentation often take the longest time of diagnosis. And some early ethnic data actually suggests that African Americans might be more likely to present with an area postremia as their first event. So they actually take longer to have time of diagnosis. There are a couple questions about the concept of progression in NMOSD. And currently, by the IPND criteria, we consider progression in NMOSD a red flag. All the disability that's acquired in NMOSD is really attack-driven. It comes from the acute event that happens. Now, in real life, it is really hard to tease out. Is their spasticity not well controlled? Are they deconditioned? Did they gain 40 pounds from the steroids that they were on, and now they have a harder time walking? So we are learning and having emerging concepts in multiple sclerosis called progression independent of relapse activity. And that is not really thought at this point in time to be seen in neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder. But another area that as we continue to expand our research, you might be something that comes out. I'm not convinced at this point in time that it will come out, but not something that we think we see right now, but we really have to focus on those symptoms.
I think I disagree with the field,
okay.
And I will tell you why.
Fair.
If you think of MS lesions in the spinal cord and patients with MS that show a stable MRI year after year after year, but they're deteriorating, right? They're having more difficulty walking. Part of it is being sedentary, right, or not mobility issues, but part of it is Wallerian degeneration, anterograde and retrograde from the lesions in the spinal cord, and I don't know why it wouldn't happen in a spinal cord with a lesion caused by NMOSD, but it would happen in a lesion with MS. So to me, I do see patients with NMOSD that have had it for some time, that do progress and eventually don't walk, so that to me is progression and it makes sense. Right, because there's that Wallerian degeneration factor that we cannot measure, but it's there and it makes sense. So it will be proven at some point, I'm sure.
And so early on when our patients have just been diagnosed with NMOSD, similar to what we do with MS, we really encourage a healthy lifestyle. Weight, keep a weight low, walk, do anything you can to encourage that, because That is the wellness treatment that they need. If my patients say, can I go to acupuncture? Go ahead. Can I get massages? Oh, go ahead. Do whatever. Right. The complementary medicines, things that will make them feel better. And as we know, a little bit of exercise and a little bit of weight loss always makes people feel a little better, especially psychologically, because they can do more. So I think that's another really important thing that we have to tell our patients.
Agree.
Want me to change this? Just mark those?
Here is the QRS code if you'd like to request and collect your CME credits, both for in-person, and then there's a virtual code as well. If you go one more slide. Okay. Sorry, I'm trying to group some of these questions because a lot of them are very, very typical. So routine monitoring for patient on immunosuppressive therapy. So it depends on what therapy they're on and what their infection risk is and what their other comorbidities are. I do personally see these patients on average of every 4 to 6 months in the clinic. Even in the era of virtual, I absolutely want to see them once a year in person. I want to see how their symptoms are doing. I want to make sure I update their medical history, their surgical history. Who knows if they had their appendix out or broke their hand and had surgery in the interim. And then I monitor their liver, their kidney, their CBC. I do try to keep at least an eye on their IgG if they're on B-cell therapy, but more importantly, I look at how many times they've been on antibiotics in the past year, how many infections they've been treated for, but we always have that risk-benefit discussion, and I've kept people on immunosuppressive therapy well into their 70s and 80s with neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder if they've been active. Mm-hmm. How about you, Dr. Nelson?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I will just add, you know, when I arrived in Miami 2 years ago, there were over 200 patients with NMO, and some of them very advanced. And there was one in particular that I thought I could not do anything for. But, you know, some of these patients just want to feel like someone's listening to them and is trying to make things better for them, no matter how much disability you have. And you have that power. Mm-hmm. You know, even if they were misdiagnosed or they're in a wheelchair, whatever, I would say when you see that patient, always ask yourself, what can I do to make this patient's life better? And they notice and they appreciate it. And most importantly, they thrive. They start thriving and they do get a little better no matter what. So, you know, take-home point is if you're there for your patients, they will do well. You know, don't assume that, okay, there's nothing I can do for them and that's it. You know, I'm just going to not see them very often. There's always something you can do to make their life better, and that's so important. And I think my colleagues have made that very clear. So I just want to thank you for being here so late, for your attendance, for your involvement. You've been a wonderful audience. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.